Hello, my name is Joshua Moore, and my favorite thing to do is listen to the Cramps and write, write, write.
Welcome to the Finding Favorites podcast, where we explore your favorite things without using an algorithm. Here's your host, Leah Jones.
Hello, and welcome to Finding Favorites. It is Sunday, September 10th, a week after Labor Day. I promised you an episode last weekend. Once again, the three-day weekend and a quick trip home got in the way of me, of my editing process. I've also been trying to learn some new tools, trying to learn how to use Descript, finding myself too impatient to learn a new editing tool, but then also too impatient to edit in Audition the way I have been editing. So I'm trying to find some affordable solutions to keep the podcast going. I love doing the interviews. I have really enjoyed learning the skills of being an editor, but I'm starting to lose steam on the actual editing of a weekly podcast. So open to ideas. You know, if there's someone listening who is secretly an editor or podcast producer or who wants to learn and keep up with a weekly podcast, please feel free to send me a note. Other than that, I'm really excited to share this interview with Josh Moore with you. Josh is an author based in Seattle, and we talk about his new book, Far Sickness, that's available now. He illustrated it. He wrote it, and his 10-year-old daughter illustrated it. So to celebrate, they are doing some workshops with 826 Valencia on parent-kid artistic collaboration. Really exciting stuff. So I hope that you have had a good end of summer. If you are looking forward to the High Holy Days, I hope those are meaningful. I'm looking forward to baking some challah this year. It's been a few years since I've made challah for Rosh Hashanah. And there's a new RSV vaccine out for people over 65 and probably people who are immunocompromised. So I'm going to get on that list. So there's an RSV vaccine, the flu vaccine, and we should be hearing this week about the COVID fall boosters. So it's an exciting time for vaccine news. With that said, wear your mask, wash your hands, and keep enjoying your favorite things. Hello and welcome to Finding Favorites. I'm your host, Leah Jones, and this is the podcast where we learn about people's favorite things and get recommendations without using an algorithm. It is the Friday of Labor Day weekend, which means fall is in the air, which means fall book launches are in the air. So I am here today with Josh Moore. He is the author of Far Sickness, which was illustrated by his daughter. We're going to get into that. He is the author of 5 novels, including Damascus, which the New York Times called Beat Poet Cool. He's also written Some Things That Meant the World to Me, one of O Magazine's 10 Terrific Reads of 2009, and All This Life, winner of the Northern California Book Award. Termite Parade was an editor's choice on the New York Times bestseller list, and his memoir, Model Citizen, was an Amazon editor's pick. And in his Hollywood life, he sold projects to AMC, ITV, and Amblin Entertainment. You're joining us today from Seattle, Josh. How are you doing?
I'm doing really well, Leah. I'm looking forward to nerding out with you.
Yeah. So are you in Seattle for the holiday weekend, or just like you're taking a sabbatical up there?
Well, I mean, I would love to say it's a sabbatical, but I have a feeling it's probably going to be too long to be considered that. You know, we had a really beautiful apartment in San Francisco and then had a child. Mm-hmm. Eventually she was going to look at me and be like, why do I live in a closet, Dad? Like, shouldn't you get your shit together?
Yeah.
So even though, like, you know, Seattle is very expensive compared to the rest of the country, it is much cheaper than San Francisco.
Yes. And there's more space available.
There is. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. My brother and cousin and her family all made the move from Indiana to Seattle. So I understand the draw.
Well, if you're an introvert or an artist, like, I don't need a very good excuse to spend all my time inside. So 10 months of rain is great.
Oh, sorry, I can't go on that hike today. There was rain.
Oh. I would love to go schlepping through the mud, but I just can't do that. Sorry.
Fair. So your publicist is one of my favorite people because she sends me new authors all the time and has made so many wonderful introductions over the course of my podcast. And your new book, Far Sickness, is coming out this fall. And you mentioned illustrated by your daughter.
Yeah. Crazy is that, right?
That's so cool. Ava.
Ava, yeah, she was 9 when we illustrated it. She has since turned 10.
Very important.
But I gotta tell you, I've done some cool things as an artist, but I'm not sure that I've ever done anything that was meaningful as an artist. And then to watch her activate in this like creative sense and to feel artistically empowered, like, it was just a beautiful experience.
Yeah. So did she do just the cover art, or is there art throughout the whole book?
When I talked to the publisher, I let them know that I wanted it to be illustrated.
Yeah.
And they sent me the work of 3 artists that they thought might fit.
Mm-hmm.
But it was very kind of Frank Miller inspired, like clean, monochromatic.
Yeah.
And the book didn't need that kind of energy. The
yeah.
book needed a more whimsical energy. So I said to the publisher, I go, let me have a friend of mine do 1 reference, and then we'll use that to see what we can find.
Mm-hmm.
So I had Ava do 1 watercolor, and I sent it in, and the guy goes, this is great. Why can't your friend just do it? And I was like, uh-oh. Do I have to tell him the truth?
Because the friend is my daughter. It's nepotism, baby.
I called my agent and said, when do I have to tell him that it's my kid? And my agent, without skipping a beat, goes, as soon as you sign the fucking contract. So that's what I did. As soon as everything was official, then I alerted the powers that be that my co-collaborator is only 9 years old.
I love that. Cowboy, you are... Sorry, my cat is like... cannot get comfortable. He's just dancing on my keyboard. There he goes.
We're having an inspiring conversation.
Yeah.
He wants to be a part of it.
Yeah. He loves every time this microphone comes out, he's like, oh, I got to be there. I got things to say. So has she read the novel? Like, did you read her things? Did you say, hey, can you do an illustration that, wait, let's back up. Do you want me to read the synopsis of the novel that is on the website, or do you want to give a little synopsis?
Sure. Yeah, I could probably just do it orally.
Yeah.
You know, this is a story about it's not a children's story by any stretch of the imagination. Like, this is a capital A adult story that I wrote to sort of sit in the sweet spot between Pan's Labyrinth, which is one of my favorite Guillermo del Toro movies, and then also a little bit of American Sniper. So the story is about an Afghan war veteran who comes home, and as he's reestablishing a status quo, he starts to hear a voice in his head, and the voice is calling him home. The voice is calling him home to Scotland, to a castle. But the catch is that he's never been to Scotland or a castle in his whole life.
Right.
So the idea of far sickness is based on the Gaelic word fernois, which means that you're homesick for a place that you've never been before, which felt like a very fertile metaphor to talk about, you know, PTSD. I'm not a veteran, and so I'm not trying to talk about a soldier story. What I'm trying to do is use that as a metaphor so we can all sort of talk about the low-grade PTSD that we're all emerging from lockdown from. Because I went into lockdown with this much of a grip on reality. And I'm not sure I came out in a very good place. And I know that I'm not alone in that, and we're not talking about it.
Right.
And so I wanted to write this book that could hopefully be something to get us talking about the things that we should be talking about. Because I feel like there's a lot of, there's like a willful roaring 20s going on right now.
Right.
Where we're traveling, we're boozing, we're this, we're that, the other. We're right. doing everything except thinking about the, you know, the trauma that we all went through.
Yeah. Yeah. And did you, was your family, were you in San Francisco in that small apartment during lockdown?
Thank
or had you already
God.
Gotten up to no. Seattle?
If we were in the small apartment, my wife would have stabbed me in the face about 47 times. And I would have deserved it, Leah.
Yeah.
but no, thankfully we were up here and had a little bit more room to maneuver. But,
yeah.
you know, I think we all had this slake or this appetite to escape, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the idea about being homesick for a place we've never been before, that certainly was a component of my doom scrolling, right?
Yeah.
Which was like, I want to go to Thailand. I want to go to Portugal. I want to yeah. go to fucking Venus. Any place except yep. my house is where I want to go.
One of my friends and I early, I mean, it was probably only like May of 2020. So we thought it was ending soon. But I remember a night where we were like on Zoom and we were looking at, we're both single. Neither of us have like, are about to be engaged. But we were like deep in Disney wedding, like, what does it cost to have a wedding in Epcot? What time of day? How many? Who would you invite? And we were just like deeply planning. I am not a Disney person. I'm not dating anyone. But we were, it was that like you had to put yourself somewhere else.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
There was the thing that was really messing me up at the time, too, is this like I didn't even know what I wanted.
Yeah.
Like I was so confused and the whole world felt so on fire at the time that I wouldn't have even been able to build like a hierarchical list of what I was desiring at the time.
Yeah.
I just knew that I was confused and I knew that I was mad and I knew that I was sad.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know what to do with those raw materials. I just know that they were sort of eating me up, you know. And
yeah.
The nice thing about being a writer as opposed to another kind of artist is that, you know, I don't need anybody else to express myself.
Mm-hmm.
So my rock and roller friends who couldn't see their bands were climbing the walls.
Yeah.
But those of us who make sense via the written word, it was very easy for me to try to sink my teeth into a creative project that was encompassing this confusion. Because ultimately, I think when art's at its highest level, it's this nourishment, this umbilical cord that happens between artist and audience, where I can
mm-hmm.
say, like, I'm really confused about some stuff. Are you really confused about the same stuff?
Yep.
Like, let's have a conversation.
Yeah. So you have this very adult novel about PTSD mm-hmm. and this idea of farsickness, which now it just makes perfect sense. Of like a longing of a place you've never been to and may never
yeah.
go to. Like I'm Jewish and that's built into the religion.
Great.
A longing
Great.
For Israel was always a part of the prayers before Israel became a state in 1948. And it continues to be because it's not just like the state of Israel. It's more like this isn't going to translate well in audio, but like the state of Israel, but not the political state, but like the
right.
emotional place,
yeah,
the
Absolutely.
Homeland. So that the word rings so immediately true to me. So what is the process then of sharing moments with your daughter for her to be inspired to do the art to go with it?
Well, what I asked her to do, she made the first painting. Like, I have to make sure, like, I have to check my dad bias, right? So
mm-hmm.
I sent her painting to, like, my five meanest friends.
Yeah.
And I was like, just tell me, like, is this rose-colored glasses or is she actually good at this? Because I think these are really cool.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, no, it's great, man. Like, you can rock this. So I told her what I wanted to do. I wanted her to do 10 watercolor illustrations that, and the pictures would tell the arc of the story in lockstep with the language.
Yeah.
And the really exciting thing was that it wasn't a one-way collaboration. Like I wrote the words first and then helped her figure out what we were going to talk about
yeah.
visually. But some of her pictures were better than the written descriptions I had put in the text. So I went back and made a bunch of changes in the book based on the illustrations that she had done. So, you know, to have a real artistic collaboration, it can't be a one-way street. And so I really allowed her to inspire me, just as the language was inspiring the paintings that she was putting together.
That's so cool. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm trying to give her a sneaky art education.
You know, right.
If I push too hard, she's going to like turn into something awful like a lawyer. Right. Mm-hmm. So I got to be very, very gentle, but I just want to model that, like, you know, even though we're living through death rattle capitalism or whatever the hell you would call this place, that it is possible to honor your art in a society that doesn't necessarily value art, that she can go on to express herself however she wants to.
Yeah. Does she get art in school? Does she still have art classes in school?
A little bit. We do a lot of that stuff around the house. Like, I'm a failed musician, so she and I are writing songs together. She already wants to work on another story together. So.
Oh, that's great.
It's fun.
You might enjoy, I had on my podcast maybe now about 6 months ago, Michael Shelley. He's a musician and he's a DJ at WFMU, which is a radio station in New York. It's one of the only free form radio stations left in the country. And he and his daughter Juniper have made music together for years. And now she's doing solo albums, but they've got some beautiful collaborations.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I went to see Patti Smith last Wednesday and I didn't realize that her son was the guitarist in the band.
Oh, nice.
And it just added another like layer of heartbeat to the whole festivities.
Yeah. So how are you celebrating the launch?
I don't know. I don't really, I'm not superstitious like that. You know, like my big ethos, right, is just I make stuff.
Yeah.
I try to keep my eye on what I'm supposed to keep my eye on, which is like the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. So when I've got idle time or when I look to the marketplace is usually when like my icky genes get up, you know, like I want this, I want that. Ooh. And I try not to engage that part of myself as much as I possibly can.
Okay. So
I spent this morning working on the next book.
That's great. That's also the only way you've published so many books already.
Well, my last book was a memoir called Model Citizen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even when the New York Times review came out, like I told my agent or my editor, like, I don't want to know. Tell me if it's good or not, but like, I can't read it.
Yeah.
Like, they're not judging it, the book. They're talking about my life. And it's not healthy. Yeah. You know, when I was in rehab, actually, the probably the best piece of advice I got was what other people think of you is none of your business. And I really try to abide by that philosophy.
Okay. Yeah.
It's hard in the social media era too, right? Because it's just a click away. In a weird way, like it's the most ubiquitous and the most socially acceptable addiction that the world has ever known.
Yeah.
And that like people go every day, people go to a place, social media, that makes them either mad or sad.
Mm-hmm.
And they go there every day. I mean, that's what it was like when I was a junkie.
Yeah. And it's like food, you're right? Like, because you probably, many of us have jobs that require checking email, right? So the email takes you onto your phone. I for many years worked in social media for brands and agencies. And now I just have like a marketing operations day job in a financial services firm. And I am no longer required to keep up with every new site, to join everything. And I'm like, oh, it turns out I'm in fact not an early adopter. I like the things I like. I am stubborn. I'm sad that Elon Musk has ruined Twitter. Because I met some of my nearest and dearest there in the aughts. But I am so grateful it is no longer required to live for me, at least.
for sure. Like I was on Twitter and Facebook for years, right up until Trump got elected.
Yeah.
And then when I was sort of watching like the early kindling of the tire fire that it all turned into, I was like, I gotta get out of here. It's not good for my mental health.
No, you made the right choice. So many of the rest of us made the wrong choice on that one.
Yeah. It is a phantom limb, though. You know, you get used to sort of being, you know, you get these little food pellets, you know, and to, you have to train yourself not to run on that digital dopamine, right? So it does take a little bit of a detox. The first couple of weeks, you're sort of squinting like a, you know, a miner coming out of the cave-in, like looking up at the sun.
Yep.
And then eventually the cool thing in my world anyways was suddenly my workday got 2 or 3 hours longer.
Yeah.
Like you don't even realize because it's 5 minutes here, 10 minutes there, but it really adds up fast.
Yeah, it really, and it takes away from like paying strong attention to what's in front of you, the bigger project. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I don't know, but in your world, how do you think when you were the most engaged, what do you think the breakdown was between your digital life versus your analog life?
Oh, I mean, I was just on it. I was on Twitter constantly, and I tried to, because I taught people social media. Like I was a social media coach. I worked with rabbis and rock stars, and then I worked with brands. And I would try and teach people, right? Like Twitter, social media, it's never going to stop. You're never going to see everything. Right. So just step into it, like step into the creek, step into the river, see what's happening then. And then just like walk away knowing things are going to pass. You're going to miss things. And I would try to embrace that. Like I'm here for, you know, like the law of 2 feet, the right people are in the room. I'm here for what I'm here for. And then I leave, but it was, you know, I was constantly on it, but it's been interesting this last couple weeks of just news. Because it was my job to alert my agency when there was a mass shooting and we needed to stop doing social media.
Right.
So they, like, I knew about the Boston bombing at the marathon before it was on CNN. Cause I was on, like, that's how extremely online I was. And I knew about Parkland. And I knew about a lot of these big shootings before they were on the news. And I would send out the agency note that said, whatever you're doing, stop it. Like slow. And so I was like the moral voice of shit just got too crazy for marketing. And not doing that anymore. Like this hurricane that just hit Florida, I'm like no longer tracking every shooting and every hurricane. And I was a little bit like, oh, was there a hurricane? Did some, you know, or somebody wrote me about a shooting and I was like, I don't know about it. And I can't. So I feel a little disconnected, but at the same time, it's okay not to know about every emergency.
Right.
And it doesn't mean I don't care about climate change. And it doesn't mean I don't care about gun control. It just means that I can't take in every headline at every minute anymore.
Yeah. And in a weird way, it sort of turns us all into like emergency room workers, right? Where you get kind of like, you get seduced or you get locked into sort of the heat of the adrenaline and the endorphins of those moments.
Yeah. So I have been really, I'm very grateful that I am no longer responsible for there was a shooting. And then the very gross decision of were enough people hurt that it should impact our marketing decisions.
Oh boy.
Right?
Yeah. Yikes.
Ugh. I'm really,
I got a really nice piece of advice from an early publicist who used to say, like, you know, you want to you should market your book with the same level of integrity with which you wrote the book. So, you know, if social media is fun for you, like if that's a font of you like enjoying the time there, like then do it. And the things that feel icky or don't feel like are not going to seem earnest or sincere because you can smell it, you know, when somebody's just there to like sell a copy, and you can sell, you can tell when somebody's actually there to build a vibrant community.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And I think what's fun about doing the podcast, and I think about half of my guests are authors, and it's been a blast because it has introduced me to people that I wouldn't have picked up off a shelf on my own. Yeah. And it's allowed me now to like draw connections between all these different modern literary traditions and communities that are happening, and make introductions sometimes like between different authors I've met with. But I think you're right. I do feel a difference between the people that are like, no, podcasting is a fun thing that I enjoy doing as part of book launches, versus people who would much rather be doing a written interview.
Well, I was teaching at a writer's conference over the weekend, and I got done workshopping a certain artist's work, and she and I were taking a walk afterward to have a little post-mortem / autopsy, depending on how you want to think about it. And I asked her a question about the book, and she kind of cut me off and goes, "What do you think my brand is?" And I was just like, I was just dying inside, you know, like, "You're not worried about the book?
Yeah.
You're worried about your brand?"
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I don't know. I just want to, like, when I hear things like that, I just want to like pull the duvet over my head and order Thai food for 3 weeks.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Far Sickness is available. It's available now. Yes.
Yeah. It's everywhere.
Great.
Everywhere. I actually think I'm not sure when this is going to go live, but my sense is that, oh, good. The first couple weeks of September is free on Kindle, too. So if anyone wants to load up their e-readers just to see if I'm crappy at my job or not, it won't cost you anything.
There you go. I'll have a link to bookshop.org in the show notes so that people can support an indie bookstore. Also Kindle or the Libby app. I'm sure there's some libraries that have got it in their mix as well. Awesome. So Josh, as promised, the book is what gave us a reason to talk this weekend.
Yeah.
But we wanted to also dive into some of your favorite things.
My favorite things?
Yeah.
I love favorite things. Which favorite things should we talk about first?
Well, you said that there was a way that like Tom Waits interacted with Alice in Wonderland in the building of this book. So we could either start with Tom Waits, Alice in Wonderland, and then how they work together, or we could dive in the deep end of like how they work together.
Oof, you had me at deep end.
All right.
You know, I believe that it's the job of every writer to challenge themselves on a project by project basis, right? So I want to imagine that I'm stringing my artistic high wire at a little bit more nauseating altitude with every new book that I put together. Authors always ask, you know, what's at stake for our characters? And of course, I have no problem with that question, but we should also ask what's at stake for you as the storyteller.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not risking public humiliation, like, to me, that's just sitting around and smelling your own farts. Like, you have to keep challenging yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And so every new book starts with this, you know, odd juxtaposition of raw materials.
Mm-hmm.
And Far Sickness started with a Tom Waits quote from his song Swordfish Trombones that just says, "He came home from the war with a party in his head and an idea for a fireworks display." And I've loved that song forever. Tom Waits is one of my guys. You know? But I also love surrealism and I love road trip stories, you know, so Alice in Wonderland is one of my favorite, you know, morphine inspired road trip stories, you know, to Lewis Carroll.
the first time I've ever heard it described as a road trip story, but it is.
It absolutely is.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And what's cool about it is we have a character who goes on an absolute journey. And if 10 people read the book, they're going to absolutely think that Alice went to Wonderland.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And half the people are going to think like she took a nap and dreamed some stuff.
Right.
And, you know, trying to empower that ambiguity. So there's no such thing as a right answer there. You can read it both ways.
Right.
In Farsickness, you can read this whole thing as happening in Hal's haunted house, his cathedral, his brain, mm-hmm. right? Or you can read it as though like he actually goes to Scotland into this castle and all hell breaks loose. And
yeah.
you know, much like Alice in Wonderland, it's all about you know, a picaresque adventure where we're meeting all of these really cool and visceral and vibrant secondary characters along the way. And you know, in Farsickness, there's an 11-year-old girl with a bullet wound through her cheek. There's a character called the Lacerated Queen who, if she doesn't eat a grenade every 3 hours, her head explodes. There's a man bat named Boris, and it gets even weirder from there. But what I love about Alice in Wonderland and Tom Waits in conversation with Farsickness is it's realism. Like, Alice in Wonderland is realism from Alice's perspective.
Okay.
And Farsickness is realism coming from Hal's perspective. From the mm-hmm. audience's perspective, it seems batshit fucking crazy.
Yeah.
Right? But in the consciousness of the main character, it makes perfect sense.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the balancing act about like having this, you know, fun as hell, past the popcorn road trip.
Mm-hmm.
But if I've done my job right, there's also this kind of livid subtext. You know, there's this, the conversation under the conversation is usually where the magic happens.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite writers is a woman named Grace Paley.
Okay.
Who's no longer with us. If you've never read Grace, her book, Enormous Changes at the Last Minute, is it's just a showstopper. And Grace is a teacher her whole life. And she used to tell her students, you know I've written one story when I've written two stories. You know, and the idea that like there has to be a literal story, of course.
Right.
But there has to be the subtext. There has to be the subtextual action.
Yeah.
And if once the storyteller has doted evenly on both planes of that story, that's when it gets really, really exciting.
Mm.
So yeah, Hal's going to go to a castle and he's going to be in Scotland and all sort of crazy shit's going to happen. But
yeah.
like, that ain't what the book's about, you know?
Yeah. so many questions. When you were writing Farsickness, are you an outliner or are you, you sit down and write and this, and the, and Hal comes out? Like, did
I have a very subversive programming. Like, I'm a lifelong punk rocker and I don't like to listen to instructions so much that I won't even listen to myself tell me what to do.
Okay.
Like, how messed up is that? Like, if I wrote a note right now that was like, hey, tomorrow, Josh, I have a great idea for a new story. You should write it down.
Mm-hmm.
I will read that note tomorrow and be like, you can't tell me what to do.
Yep.
Down with the man.
Yep. A little oppositional defiance right back at yourself.
Absolutely. Yep. And so, you know, I write, you know, every writer has to figure out a process that sort of brings out the best in their imagination, certainly, but also in their work ethic.
Yeah.
And in my world, what that means is I can only know the opening image of a narrative. I know chapter one. I've known it for all my books, but I never know what's going to happen afterward.
Mm.
Like, I love that reckless process of discovery is why I write.
Yeah.
Like, that's where I have like the biggest heat, you know, when it's that like I have a blank canvas and there are no right answers. There are no wrong answers. I'm going to drink another espresso shot. I'm going to turn the music up and I'm just going to see what happens.
Yeah. Are you a daily word count? I'm guessing this is a no, like that you're not 1,000 words a day.
I don't,
writer?
I can't think about it like that. Like I don't track word count. I just count like, I try to honor my art every day.
Yeah.
And one of the ways that I keep myself clean is that when the witching hour strikes, that's when I go to work. So I'm a nocturnal writer.
Okay.
I try to just, you know, I run an editorial business. I try to be a good father, and that takes up the majority of my day.
Yeah.
And then usually about 11 or midnight is when I'll finally get to work.
Wow.
And then I'll work until 4 or 5, take a disco nap and rinse, wash, repeat.
Amazing.
I wouldn't recommend this style of writing to anybody.
Fair.
But it's been, it's not only helped me artistically, but it's really helped me spiritually and existentially. Mm-hmm. When I get those squawking voices telling me to go out and debase myself,
yeah,
I try to just debase a character instead.
Outstanding. So Tom Waits, you said one of your OGs.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember who or how you were introduced to his music?
I do. Fight Club.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, there's the scene where they're like first going to go into the basement of the bar.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the songs off his record Bone Machine is playing.
Okay.
Called Going Out West. And I was like, why don't I know who this is? Because, like, you know, I grew up in the East Bay of California.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in high school. Then I moved to San Francisco when I was 17. So I've been a punk rock kid my whole life.
Yeah.
So I didn't even know who Tom Waits was until I heard this song. And then, you know how this happens to us all the time, whether it's a film or it's a television show.
Mm-hmm.
You come across a piece of art and you're like, I've been waiting for this. I didn't know I was waiting for this,
yeah,
but I've been waiting for this. And so when I started to do research about him, he did a trilogy of records in the 80s. It's Rain Dogs, Frank's Wild Years, and Swordfish Trombone. And those would be like my high water mark in his oeuvre. I mean, there are lots of different things to appreciate and admire.
Yeah.
But those, if I had to take 3 records to a desert island, those would be the records I would take with me. Yeah.
Have you ever had the opportunity to see him perform?
I've seen him a couple times. Once at one of Neil Young's Bridge School benefits, I saw him with the Cronus Quartet at the same time.
Oh, that's
that
cool.
That's amazing.
Cool. Yeah.
Yeah. But what I like about Tom too is, like, you know, if you're a writer or an artist of any kind, like, Tom is emblematic of what I would say is the most important thing that we have to hold on to. Like, what we have to hold on to is our singular vision of self-expression.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I believe that, you know, nobody else on planet Earth has an imagination like Leah Jones.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that nobody else on Earth has an imagination like Josh Moore or Tom Waits or Lewis Carroll, for that matter.
Yeah.
So as long as you're making the art that only you can make, as long as you're not chasing the idiosyncrasies of an era, trying to sell a couple desperate copies,
mm-hmm,
those are the things that cascade meaning and have the potential to transcend time.
Yeah. So the same sort of time travel question for Alice in Wonderland. Do you remember your first encounter with Alice in Wonderland? Was it the animation and then you found the book, or did a grandparent put the book in your hands? How did you get to know Alice?
I grew up in a haunted house, for lack of a better phrase, where there was not much art being ingested or metabolized.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't actually read a book until I was a senior in high school. I had a high school, I think I was supposed to write a book report on something awful, like the Red Badge of Courage or something,
mm-hmm,
like that. And my senior year high school teacher was like, look, I know you didn't read this book. If you don't, I'm going to hand you something else right now. If you don't read it over the weekend and write a book report, you're not going to graduate. And he handed me a copy of Vonnegut Slaughterhouse-5.
Okay.
And I went home and was like, wait, books can do this?
Wow.
I didn't know books could do this before.
Yeah.
And so I went back when I handed in the report and I was like, give me a list. And he gave me all the things that a boy of, 17 years old would love. It was, Orwell and Selby and Burroughs and Kerouac, Richard Brautigan. And one of them was Lewis Carroll. And I said to him, I said, isn't this a children's book?
Right.
And he just started laughing at me. He goes, just read it.
Yeah.
Just read it. So in a weird way, I'm glad that I didn't interact with a more like watered down Disney version
right.
of the story and just got to hear it from Lewis Carroll's mouth directly first. And then I did all the other stuff just to see how it has been honored and updated over the years. But it's always nice to start with the horse's mouth.
Yeah. Does that high school teacher know that you became an author?
I reached out to him when all that crazy Oprah stuff happened with my first book and like sent him this like gushy, very long, very self-important email that I thought was like going to make a big difference in his world. And then he never answered me.
Oh, bummer.
So there you go. It's kind of an inspiring story until it's not.
It's amazing though. I think it's really, teachers are under fire so much right now for everything, but especially the books that like classroom libraries, librarians, and so much future art and self-knowledge and world knowledge is going to just be shunted.
Yeah,
because teachers
absolutely.
Can't do what what he did for you, which is put a book in your hand that then changed probably the course of your life.
It absolutely changed my life. And, I think about this all the time, especially in modern publishing. I realize this is going to sound a little get off my lawn, but we're all friends here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm reading a lot of books right now that don't have a lot of blood in their veins.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're super competently told and they're like really cleanly edited, but they also feel like they've kind of been slathered in Purell.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking we were just talking about Selby, Hubert Selby's book or Orwell's. I just reread Down and Out in Paris.
Okay.
These are kind of ugly books that have a lot of grit under their fingernails, but those idiosyncrasies, that lack of homogeneity, I would say is what makes them unique and special. We're living through this era of beige against the machine right now where everything sounds like a copy of a copy of a copy.
Mm-hmm.
To me, art should always emanate from the place that the great Cesar Cruz used to talk about, that art should, disturb the comfortable and comfort the disturbed. That's the sweet spot that I'm always trying to write toward. And that's going to make some people uncomfortable. And I don't know when it became a bad thing to make people a little uncomfortable, but we're living through this moment right now where everybody wants what they want.
Yeah. Right. I wonder if some of it is right. Like a lot of what's hitting the market now are COVID projects.
Yep.
Right. They're either what people wrote in lockdown or started, like that is all now starting to hit the market.
Yeah.
It's fascinating because like this podcast was my COVID hobby. I wasn't commuting. I got 10 hours a week back. I live alone. I needed to have a reason to talk to people. So I started a podcast.
Projects
had all been started
with
pre-COVID
millions of other people.
And maybe edited during lockdown, but it was all pre-COVID effort.
Yeah.
And now I'm talking to authors and these are their lockdown projects. Is what is now starting to hit the market.
Yeah, and it's, I think anything that's dealing with COVID, like I run an editorial business, and so I'll always do like a free half an hour consult. They think I'm doing them a favor, but really I'm just vetting to see if they're crazy or not. If someone tells me like, I want to work on my COVID book, I have to step aside. Like it's all still too fresh.
Yeah.
It's all still too raw. I don't want to dig into it right now.
Yeah.
if it's pure escapism, like that's one thing, but somebody like walking me through like the ennui and the loneliness of their particular experience, like I just got out of that. I don't want to go right back into it.
Right. But I wonder if, I don't know, it's just going to be interesting to see what continues to be published out of it. So I guess my thought was, are the things that are getting published just comfort food? Right.
It could very well be. I mean,
right. Soft blankets, comfort food.
Right before, I think it was January of 2020. I'm terrible with, I'm a 4-time stroke survivor, so my short-term memory is all messed up. But I had sold a television show to AMC.
Yeah.
And it was a gritty show. We pitched it as like The Godfather meets Lady Bird.
Okay.
And it was going to be about a matriarch of a crime family. And Sigourney Weaver actually had signed on to play our lead. And we were like, holy shit, this is amazing. And she and I were Zooming and we were talking about how we're going to put it all together. And she was taking Quebecois lessons because the script was going to require her to speak Quebecois a third of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then as soon as COVID happened, AMC cut us loose and they said, everybody wants Ted Lasso. Like nobody wants to read your dark, no one wants your dark matriarchal show anymore. Mm. Maybe someday.
Right.
So even Hollywood was just like, it was a complete recasting of what they want to lure people in with.
Right.
So it would make sense though that publishing would be doing the same thing, but publishing just takes so much longer. It's insane.
Yeah.
The great thing about Farsickness is I wrote it in May of this year.
Wait.
And this is, yeah.
Like 3 months ago?
Yes. So I have a, you know, WGA card.
Yeah.
And once we all went on strike, like I had been working on the show I had just sold to Steven Spielberg and was like, well, I can't do anything anymore.
Yeah.
So I sat down at the beginning, late April to the, you know, first week of May, and I wrote Farsickness in 3 weeks, pinged the publisher, had my daughter illustrated, and we had galleys by June. And, you know, we're talking 2 months later. So
holy shit.
In a weird way, I'm trying to kind of use this experience to just have some joy.
Yeah.
And to just have some fun. And, you know, the chance to make art with my kid was one thing. And to tell the most raucous, outlandish, surrealist story I possibly could.
Yeah. Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah, I wrote one draft in about 10 days.
Yeah.
It's a short book. It's only about 19,000 words. I don't want anybody at home to be like, oh my God, what is he, Goodwill Hunting? He wrote a whole book in like 3 weeks. it's a little story. But what I wrote one draft and I sent it to a couple buddies and they gave me a couple things to work on and I executed that and I just planted a flag in it and said, this is done. This is what it wants to be. And so let's just share it with people.
How long do you feel like you carried the Tom Waits lyric in your pocket? How long was that scratching at you waiting for a book?
10 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are certain songs or, you know, certain scenes in movies that it might not even be a direct influence in terms of like what is happening in the scene, but, you know, a tonal thing or something aesthetic that you think is exciting that, you know, someday you want to try.
Yeah.
I think most writers or artists, you know, would carry around, you know, a litany or a stable of, you know, images and conceits that they're hoping that they're going to be able to execute on until their time here is done. And you just sort of hold those in a very open-hearted way. And you just wait for the muse to start squawking in your ear. And, you know, once she starts talking, like I clear my schedule because you never know when she's going to shut up again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you went into the summer and into the strike heading. You didn't say you write in your attic, but for some reason I imagined you go to the attic to write. But that may not be true. That's just where I imagined you going.
I'm a subterranean. We're in the basement.
Okay. So you went to the basement. You just let it. You went with Hal to Scotland.
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah, yep. Yeah, I wanted to, and the other thing about Hollywood too is, you know, you have to think about how expensive things are going to be and locations. Right. And that was the fantastic thing about Far Sickness is like, I'd make it as expensive and crazy as I wanted to, because it didn't matter.
Right.
So I was like, oh, I'm going to have a submarine crash halfway through the book. And no one's going to be like, no one's going to wag their finger in my face about budget.
Right. Yeah. No studio execs giving notes.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
If nothing else comes from the strike, at least I got a few months off of that, right?
Yeah. Everything I'm learning about the strike and the business, I because I live alone, I spend a lot of podcasts are like my roommates, essentially. Spend a lot of time with podcasts on. And many of the podcasts I listen to are either SAG or WGA members on strike and talking about, you know, the projects they're trying to work on with the time they have now, or I don't know. It's I'm learning a lot as someone not in that system.
Yeah.
Through podcasters talking about the strike and what is different about their life now.
Well, I think the thing that the general public is probably misinterpreting the most is seeing like, thinking about the WGA as a united front, which we are, but the AMPTP is not a united front.
Right.
Like what the legacy studios want is way different than what, I'm not going to call them streamers. I'm going to call them technology companies, because that's what they are. So what the technology companies want and the legacy studios, they do not want the same thing. And in fact, they are rooting for one another's demise.
Yeah.
And trying to negotiate with people that have a prey-predator relationship is certainly a precarious needle to thread, Leo.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems, I don't know. But it is also interesting to see how it is. I mean, unions were on the rise before the strike, but there was the IATSE movement last year, and then they didn't go to strike, if you paid attention, you learned about IATSE and you learned about the importance of PAs and tech and stagehands. And, you know, Chicago's got a couple of Starbucks that have unionized. We're just starting to see, I think, a modern rise of unions.
Absolutely.
And in fact,
during when we were picketing in July in LA, the UPS union threatened to go on strike in LA County because they wanted air conditioning in their trucks.
Right.
And UPS settled very quietly with them when we were all picketing together in July. So, you know, they as a monolith have systematically dismantled the middle class. And those of us who are outside the castle walls are starting to look around like, we think things might need to change soon.
Yeah. Yeah.
You can feel that animosity and that volatility. I think it's quite exciting.
I think so, too. I also grew up, my elementary school was across the street from Eugene V. Dubb's house. He was a socialist, presidential candidate, union labor rights, like he's an icon. But so I went to an elementary school with WPA murals. So right with the, you know, after the Great Depression, the huge investment in public arts. So my elementary school and junior high had these incredibly political murals.
Oh, I love this.
About like anti-capitalist, pro-labor, pro-farming, like about the Boy Scouts and scouting and the danger, but also like the danger of going from the Boy Scouts into the army.
Right.
And dying on the battlefield. So those were the murals I grew up with at my elementary and junior high. And then every year we went to Eugene V. Dubb's house because it was across the street. So you didn't need much of a permission slip. So it's a really interesting to me, like weird little education to have come up with that is not kind of like not a typical Indiana education.
Well, it seems like it's really an important conversation that we should all be having too. Like, you know, having one foot in a writer's guild, but then look at the state of novelists and memoirs. I mean, publishing is a fucking disaster right now.
Yeah.
Like, nobody knows what sells books. In fact, I've got some writer friends right now who are saying, like, do I even want to go a traditional route to the marketplace?
Right.
You know, and it's like, I've climbed those mountains, so I'm able to, you know, talk with a certain level of expertise, but it almost feels like any sort of information that's more than 6 months old is almost obsolete.
Yeah.
Right now, it feels like, you know, they're going to give some dim-witted, you know, celebrity $2 million and then the rest of us who might actually have something interesting to say are going to fight over 40 grand. Like, yeah. It doesn't make any sense. Like, no one's earning a living wage.
Right.
If we're trying to get rid of art in our country, well, congratulations, I guess.
Right.
Just going to stay in the basement and write my weird little stories, Leah. I'm better in the basement.
Yeah. Great. Well, Josh, this has been so fun. Is there anything have you introduced your daughter to Tom Waits or Alice in Wonderland yet?
I didn't. She knows who Tom Waits is. There's a big painting of him on our wall over there. And she knows his records because when we make art together, there's a record player right behind me. Mm-hmm. So we're always listening to records together.
Yeah.
Once I got Galleys, I actually let her read Far Sickness too. Like, even though it gets pretty fucking crazy towards the ending. But I've always parented her since she was a little. Always talking to her as she was an adult.
Mm-hmm.
So I've always tried to engage with her this kind of teaching poise that way, never trying to be condescending.
Yeah.
But what I'm thinking is exciting as well, I'm showing her, you know, Tom Waits and Alice in Wonderland. You know, she's showing me Taylor Swift.
Mm-hmm.
And like, we're rocking 1989 on vinyl just as much as we're rocking Rain Dogs on vinyl.
Yep.
And like, she likes Murders in the Building, which is a show I'd never seen before. So like, she's introducing me to that. So if there's this, I think with the kid anyways, I mean, what the hell do I know? There's this really exciting opportunity to learn just as much from them if we turn off our like adult mind that says that we know more, because we don't.
My sister says that a lot about raising her. She's got two boys. One just went off to college and one is a freshman in high school. And she's learned about hockey. She's learned about anime.
Yeah.
Right. The pop culture they bring into the house through like Minecraft chats and you know, D&D.
For sure.
Right? Like that it's been, she was just like, why don't people talk about how fun it is for your kids to introduce you to pop culture and hobbies? And if parents are open to that, it can be really fun.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. And in fact, Ava and I, I'm not doing a traditional book tour for this one, but what we are doing is we're doing these workshops around parents, caregivers, and children making art together.
Oh, that's
so
wonderful.
We're doing one at the beginning of, I think it's September 10th at 826 Valencia in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And the thesis basically is, every adult in the room has some hibernating artist in their chest.
Yep.
Like, I don't know if you were a sculptor or a painter or whatever it happens to be. I just know that it was there before you got under fucking water being a parent.
Yeah.
And my daughter, we had the best time putting this piece of art together. So we want to do these little seminars, hoping that it can be a conduit that other parents and other kids can have the same level of excitement and euphoria that we had making art together.
I love it. I love it. I grew up in a house where art supplies were, like, we didn't grow up with a lot of money, but we had full access to my mom's acrylics.
Oh, I love it.
Like, we were allowed to paint with acrylics and paint on canvas or random boards from my dad's shop. Like, we were allowed to make art with anything we could find in the house.
Right.
And there were always, my dad was a house painter, so there were always like books of wallpaper to be cut up and turned into wallpaper quilts. And so we grew up with like free reign access.
And such a tactile childhood too.
Yeah.
Like I love everything that you're touching in that story is worth the price of admission.
Yeah.
Very cool.
That's a fun workshop. I'm excited for you.
Even just the idea about putting it together, like it makes me want to start to cry a little bit. You know, as a parent, you're asked to store away so many of the things that used to really feed your identity.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand why we have to do it, because now we're in service of something far greater than ourselves.
Yeah.
But it's also important to remember that those gifts are there.
Yeah.
And those gifts are what make you idiosyncratically alive.
Mm-hmm.
And by not honoring them, it's not that you're squandering them. It's that you're not being completely capital Y you.
Yeah.
And so I'm really hoping that, you know, these seminars that we're doing around far sickness can help some of that.
Outstanding. Outstanding. I think you might enjoy, now I'm not going to pronounce his name right. I interviewed a surrealist poet.
Oh, you had me a surrealist poet.
Yeah. It's Benjamin. His like nickname is something pajamas, because his last name is so hard to pronounce. But I'm gonna look him up.
I kind of wish his name was Benjamin Pajamas, but whatever, that's fine.
Yeah. Finding Favorites podcast, Googling my own podcast. Nis Pojiani.
Okay. I don't know who that is, but I'll put him in my queue.
So his nickname, his online handle is Neon Pajamas.
Okay.
Benjamin Neon Pajamas. His debut collection was called No Further Than the End of the Street. And so it's sort of a poetry collection of surreal moments. It's sort of a House of Leaves cul-de-sac.
Love it.
Where everything happens on the same cul-de-sac. But it's just like anything could happen. And I think you would really enjoy his work. I'll send you a link to him. And I also think you'd have a lot of fun, and I can introduce you to Chris and Dukes at Upper Middle Brow podcast.
Thank you for listening to Finding Favorites with Leah Jones. Please make sure to subscribe and drop us a 5-star review on iTunes. Now, go out and enjoy your favorite things.